Brian.
Charles.
How are you, man?
So good to be back. So good to see you.
It's been a long time.
It has been. I've been buried and working hard, and we're going to have some good stuff to talk about before too long. So.
Excellent.
But happy birthday.
Thank you, man.
Gosh, I would never have imagined. It's already 5.
Good unbelievable.
Grief. It's unbelievable.
It's
by the way, the hat's back on because I got some mail from Niners that said, Brian, wear your hat in the videos.
Right on. I mean, and that brings up a good point because one of the things I wanted to talk to you about was your sort of thinking about on Channel 9. Like, what do you think about Channel 9? What does it mean to you?
Well, to me, Channel 9, it actually changed my experience of Microsoft.
Huh.
Because, and improved it, because you know, change could go the other way too. But it's a way for those of us inside Microsoft to share our thinking process. We're very proud of our creative processes, and it's just fun to share the insights with people who care.
Exactly.
And then the other way around is people who care get to probe the Microsoft process and get to participate to some extent in the way we do things and think about things. So the feedback goes both ways. I love hearing from the Channel Niners, from looking at the boards and seeing what do they care about. And there are lots of surprises. Mm-hmm. You don't always realize that people care about some little thing that you thought was not very important, or they don't care about some little thing that you thought was hugely important. You know, it goes both ways.
Yeah.
So it's wow. I mean, all I can say is why aren't you 15? Why aren't you 25?
Hey, it took us a while. Yeah, this is an interesting conversation. I was speaking with Len recently, who's the godfather of Channel 9. I mean, he's the guy who ran the team, and it's really his idea around creating this sort of transparency, Len Pryor.
Yeah.
And then the 5 guys from Redmond converged, and we actually pulled off what became Channel 9 as we know it.
Right.
But we were talking, and he made a really good point, and that is, corporations, by definition, are not human.
Yes.
And so that they don't know how to speak in a human way.
They're a fictitious entity.
Exactly.
Literally.
Literally.
You look at the tax form, it says DBA, doing business as, fictitious name, blah, blah.
Amen. So with Channel 9, and you just basically articulated it, we've humanized Microsoft in many ways.
Right. You know, one of the problems that Microsoft has is that we're up here in the great Pacific Northwest where, this is logging and fishing country up here. You know, that's about all there is. It's an accident that Boeing happens to be here and Microsoft happens to be here. You go down to the valley, you go down to San Francisco Valley, people move from job to job to job to job. But a lot of Microsofties are lifers. You know,
agreed.
We're kind of stuck up here. And the point is, though, because we have this isolation issue, people don't interact with us as much as they do with comparable companies down in the valley. Mm. And Channel 9 is a fantastic way of opening that up.
Absolutely.
And making people realize that we're not just crazed lumberjacks up here. We're actually computer geeks.
Yeah.
Just like everybody else. You know?
Precisely. Mathematicians, physicians.
Mathematicians,
well,
physicists.
Not physicians, physicists.
Hey, there's some physicians here too, I'm sure. I have a funny story. I may have told this on 9 before. And if I start repeating stories, then you'll know I'm an old Niner. Right?
Absolutely, you are an old Niner.
But one of the best programmers I ever hired was a dentist. He was an official dentist.
No way.
I hired him at JPL, actually.
Okay.
And he just started tinkering with computers as a hobby and completely fell in love with them, as so many of us did, in those days. And he was an extremely talented guy and had that kind of devotion that only hobbyists can, that kind of passion that only a hobbyist can. And this entire business started with hobbies, the Altair and the Apple. You know, those were hobbyist toys when they first came out. They weren't. Nobody took them seriously.
Amen.
Except Bill Gates and Steve Jobs and guys like that. Andy Gordon and
I know who you mean. So, I mean, that's really interesting because now what we're sort of doing as a company is we're trying to target the hobbyists again.
Yes, right? Yes.
When in fact, that was our original target, as you mentioned, and now
right.
We've gone hardcore on the enterprise and the pro.
Sure.
Which is a good thing because we have to create a platform for professionals.
We do.
Which is something But by the way, I want to just go really non sequitur.
Yeah, yeah.
Let's talk about that galaxy. Yeah, what's going on there? What's arrow pointing to?
I don't remember the exact name of this galaxy, but that is a supernova.
Ah.
And I don't remember the exact reason why this is being pointed out. It's a cool picture. But I do know a few things in general about supernovas. By the way, this came from one of my favorite sources of wallpaper, and that's the astronomypictureoftheday.com, APOD.
Nice.
APOD. And you just go there and you can... it's just loaded with great stuff. But a supernova for a short time, a few hours or days, will outshine the entire galaxy.
Wow.
And so you can see that this guy is pretty bright. It's not outshining right now, this entire galaxy, but for a short time it would do. And there are automated searches for supernovas now, so some of the big telescopes are able to spot them. But this one was particularly interesting for some reason, and I've just found it on APOD, and I just thought it was just cool.
It's very cool.
Yeah.
I really like the Whirlpool Galaxy. I mean, there's Earths in there, one could argue. I think there probably are. What do you think about that anyway?
Let's talk about
solar evolution. So sure. If you can think of, like, if let's, like, a G-class yellow star like our sun.
Yes.
If you decide as a physicist that part of the process or sort of something that's a side effect of the advent of a sun in the first place is going to be the creation of enough particulate matter to create planetary bodies.
Right.
If we agree that that's like something that's common, then theoretically, there could be many, 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 many planets.
Yes.
Many of which could perhaps be rocky with liquid water.
Right.
What do you think about this? What's going on in the universe today?
Well, there is a standard approach to this. It's called the Drake equation, in which Professor Drake purports to multiply up all the probabilities. What's the probability that in a galaxy like this, you know, what's the expected number of probability and expected number?
Sure.
Two sides of the same coin. What's the expected number of stars that could support life? It's not just G-class. You could have bigger star, you know, brighter stars with the zone further away. Or if there's too much ultraviolet light, it might never happen. You know, there are all kinds of criteria, but for life to evolve as we know it, you have to have liquid water and you know, enough minerals and blah, 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 that kind of thing. So you multiply all these things out, and you get and you get a nice equation called the Drake equation. You can look it up, and you can see some numbers on it. I'll give you an opinion in 1 second after I point out that this galaxy has on the order of 100 billion stars in it.
Unbelievable.
So just 10 of these galaxies with $1 per star is one stimulus package, right?
Excellent. Indeed.
But my thesis advisor, Professor Edward Turner, pointed out in a lecture that I attended about the Drake equation some 30-odd years ago now. After a while, somebody did a calculation with the equation and came up with 10 to the minus 600. As the probability that there is a planet supporting intelligent life. Now, my advisor immediately raised his hand and said, "Did you know that the probability that all of science is completely wrong is much larger than this absurd number?"
Amen.
So, you know, the Drake equation is kind of an interesting way of looking at things, but until we get another example, we're basically in the dark. We really don't have any idea. The real problem with these calculations is each factor individually is an interesting question to ask, and there's evidence, and you can build up a plausible number for each factor, and usually that number turns out to be quite small, 10 to the minus 10, 10 to the minus 20, you know, one chance in a billion, one chance in a billion. Mm-hmm. When you take two of these factors and multiply them by each other, you're now at 10 to the minus 40. We're now starting to talk about numbers that are really, really tiny. You take two of those and you get 10 to the minus 80. You take a bunch more of these and you're starting to get numbers that are so absurdly small that they don't make sense in aggregate anymore.
Yeah.
And the reason is that the evidence that, you know, suppose you have the standard Miller atmosphere with just the right amount of methane and just the right amount of carbon dioxide and carbon monoxide and nitrogen and so on, and you get the lightning storms and now, poof, you get amino acids. Mm-hmm. Well, what's the probability of that actually happening on some planet? Well, now you have to have some geophysical numbers about what's the probability that you have the right kind of atmosphere. Mm-hmm. And you have a star that's whose solar wind isn't going to blow that all away. You're starting to now combine uncertainties to the point where the uncertainties overwhelm the certainties. Mm-hmm. So as, whereas it, you might be able to get a pretty good answer about the probability of a star's having such and such features that are compatible with life, by the time you combine that with some uncertainties from planetary physics, mm-hmm. and other uncertainties from interstellar medium physics, you know, plasma physics in the interstellar medium, you know, because you can't have the solar wind blowing all the atmosphere away, and or creating magnetic storms that are so horrible that you know, cosmic rays come in and bake everything, and yeah. then you got to worry about tectonics, and is it too many earthquakes, too much geothermal. You know, one of these are individually good questions to ask, and there's some good evidence. You might be able to come up with something plausible to say, but together,
it's very difficult.
That doesn't mean we should not look.
Agreed.
It does mean that the theoretical calculations are probably not worth the paper they're written on.
Now, I mean, that brings up a good point. We could sort of tie this back to computers and programming, although that's sort of less interesting.
Yeah.
Is the notion of not knowing what we're looking for. So sort of, you know, the Heisenberg uncertainty principle is sort of, you know, not reverse, but another sort of uncertainty. That is, you're never going to be able to find something that you don't know, that you don't know what it is in the first place.
Right.
So if we make the assumption that it has to be life like ours, we're limiting the possibilities, right? So let's look at programming.
Yeah.
Right? You can write the same programming that instructs a computer to do the exact same thing in a language like C# or a language like Haskell.
Yeah.
But the way that you do it is completely different. It requires a different way of thinking that level. But the core of what you're trying to do, order the computer around, you know, various instruction sets,
right,
whatever,
right.
That's the end result. So life could actually be sort of some, you know, we have to redefine life. But this is fun to talk to you about because most people at Microsoft aren't physicists.
Right.
And you are an astrophysicist, which is incredibly interesting. Yeah. So this is Channel 9's birthday.
Yeah, yeah.
It's amazing.
Yeah.
I mean, you worked at JPL, you know, I mean, it's really sometimes mind-boggling to look at a picture like that and kind of ask yourself, what is that?
Yeah.
Because I don't know if we really, do we think we have the answer? Do we know what that is?
We know a lot of things about these little guys, but we don't by no means know everything. In fact, as I've said before, I know I've said this on Channel 9, the most embarrassing open question in all of science is the question of dark matter. We can measure the velocity of the spin velocity of this thing by watching the redshifts of these stars, and we can measure we can get an estimate of the amount of matter in here by just looking at the light, because we know how much stars weigh. From nuclear physics, you can figure out how much mass is in a star, because we understand how the nuclear reactions work. Mm-hmm. So if you can measure the brightness of a star, you can get a pretty good estimate on the mass of this brightness and the color and other features. But the amount of mass that we can see is only about a tenth of the amount of mass that's actually there. Mm-hmm. And the amount of mass that's actually there, we know from the fact that these things are spinning much faster and can be accounted for by the mass that we can see. Hmm. There's no question about it. That's an ironclad measurement. That's, you know, there's some uncertainty in the measurement, but mm-hmm. it's overwhelmingly too much.
But let me ask you this. On the one hand, what science tends to do, and I'm not, this isn't an argument about science versus not science.
Yeah, but, yeah.
I mean, we're humans, so the mechanical way of looking at this would be, well, what we think we understand, and of course, is based on mathematics.
Yes.
Right? Dark matter is a function of mathematics, right? You have to figure out how to balance these equations.
We got two equations. We got one measure of mass that comes from how fast the thing is spinning, another measure of mass that comes from how bright it is and what the colors are. Mm-hmm. And they're off by a factor of 10. This is embarrassing. This is really embarrassing.
Understood. So could one make the assumption that we don't really know what that is?
We don't know what 90% of the 90% of what's in there. We don't have any idea what it is. Mm-hmm. Could be golf balls. Could be anything.
Awesome.
It turns out not to be neutrinos, I think, is the consensus now. There was a long time people thought maybe it's neutrinos, because neutrinos are a nice place to sweep things under the rug, because they don't interact very strongly with anything. Mm. So if you want a lot of something, just say, "Hey, it's neutrinos," because you can put a lot of them in the in a small place. But it turns out that I think there were some measurements that show that it's not plausibly neutrinos. I wanted to say something about your computer example.
Yeah.
The smallest example that I can think of that illustrates your point is consider the function that squares its argument. Two ways to write that. F of x equals x squared and f of x equals x times x. Two different mathematical operations, two, you know, given whatever your computer is, you might compute it in two different ways. You might call the power function in a BCL, or you might just go push times in the CLR. Well, the answer you get for the domain for appropriate domains of x is exactly the same. So by inspecting the inputs and the outputs, you can't tell what the implementation of the function is. Mm. And I'm just giving you the tiniest example that I can think of off the top of my head. But when you get to big things like printer drivers or web services or, you know, things like this, the possibilities for implementing these programs is enormous compared, and you would never be able to tell from looking at the inputs and the outputs.
Interesting.
Absolutely fascinating, isn't it?
It really is.
And it's a deep property, by the way. It's related to undecidability. Gödel's theorem, you know, you can't, there's no general test for equality of functions. Hmm. There's a test for equality of numbers and equality of strings and things like that, but equality of functions is out there.
Indeed. Amazing. And then throw in the wonderful world of side effects, which we all love.
Oh, and then all bets are off, but
and
we
all
love
bets are off. But yeah. We love side effects.
Of course.
What would life be like without them?
They make our lives easier. Can't put your money under a mattress without a side effect, right?
Absolutely. Well, hey, I must say, I mean, I know you're very busy. We can't talk about what you're working on, but just so everyone knows, he's working on something.
Not yet. I am not asleep at my desk.
No, you are not. And I can't wait for us to be able to share this with Niners.
I can't either. It's going to rock.
Outstanding.
And you rock, too. Channel 9 absolutely rocks, and absolutely the happiest of birthdays to you.
Thank you so much, Brian.
Yeah.
Cheers.
Cheers.